Hello and welcome to the Sam Knows podcast. I'm Barry Collins. In our very first issue of Spotlight magazine, we ventured into space and examined the impact of Elon Musk's Starlink, publishing some of the first ever performance data on the satellite broadband service. Now, 18 months on, and with almost a million customers on the Starlink network, we're making a return journey. Starlink was in the headlines earlier this year, with some customers complaining about reduced speeds and inconsistent service. But was that a true reflection of Starlink's performance? To find out, I'm joined by Sam Knows founder Sam Crawford to discuss the latest Starlink performance data and whether it really has deteriorated from those impressive speeds we saw 18 months ago. We'll also talk about Starlink's competitors, the new markets the company has moved into, and what the future holds for satellite broadband services. I started by asking Sam what changes he'd seen in the Starlink data since we last reported on the service.
Well, Starlink has seen quite a lot of growth in their subscriber base, just based on the public numbers. I think they've almost tripled their subscriber base this year alone, from a couple of 100,000 users to, I think I last saw the numbers in September, about 700,000 or 800,000, which is pretty impressive. They've got to be getting close to 1 million.
Mm-hmm.
And but at the same time, they've also been launching a lot of new satellites. I think they're north of 3,000 satellites now, and opening additional ground stations, I hear. So they've been bolstering capacity whilst also greatly increasing their subscriber base. I think what we've seen in the measurements is definitely more apparent that there's periods where there's some congestion or has been some congestion. You can see the throughput figures, the speed tends to be a bit more erratic, the confidence intervals increase, confidence intervals around the latency measurements also increase. But in the past couple of months in particular, we've seen marked improvements. So it looks like they've brought on some additional capacity. But aside from increasing confidence intervals, the actual averages, both in terms of throughput and latency, are pretty much exactly the same. They've barely changed for a year, mm-hmm. Which is quite impressive, given that they've increased their subscriber base more than threefold. So the increased confidence intervals show that some users are indeed seeing far worse performance. I assume there's probably areas of significant congestion, but on average, they are holding up pretty well.
We've seen reports over the summer and autumn that Starlink performance had dropped off sharply, but the Sam Knows data suggests the average performance has remained relatively consistent. Maybe take this opportunity, Sam, to explain how the Sam Knows methodology differs.
Sure. Well, I can't talk to other people's methodology or their data in on any case, really. But I can talk about our methodology and how I know it differs from some of the others out there. So I guess the crux of it is we try and be as robust as possible in our methodology, even if that means we make other sacrifices in other places, like the pure volume of data that we collect, perhaps. But to give you some examples, the vast majority of our measurements are scheduled tests rather than user-driven on-demand tests. And that's important because it means we're generating measurements throughout a 24-hour period, even when the person's asleep and nothing is switched on inside the house, and even when no other devices are using the internet. And that kind of dovetails into the second point as well, is that our measurement agent, whether it's the white box or the agent inside ISP's routers, will look for cross-traffic and will not run measurements in the presence of cross-traffic. And by cross-traffic, I mean background traffic from other users or other devices inside the home. So, for example, if you've got, if your son or daughter is upstairs watching something on Netflix, then our measurement won't run. It will wait until there is no traffic.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a whole bunch of other things along these kind of lines. But the point here is we're trying to build a very clear picture purely of the internet connection. So not of the device inside the home in this particular case, not of performance to a test server very close to the user. We're trying to build a picture of the from the point of termination in the user's home to typically a test server located at a major internet exchange out on the internet. And I guess the last thing to add, jumping back to my earlier point, is all of our scheduled tests that run on our own hardware called the white box, and also on routers that we've embedded our agent, we'll do so from a wired device connected either directly inside or connected directly to the router. So we're not subject to things like, you know, poor in-home Wi-Fi, or you know, where the user's placed a device inside the home, or whatever software is running on the user's device at that particular point in time. Mm-hmm. All our devices are homogeneous, or the agents are homogeneous. So it's a very predictable, as clean as possible, an environment so that we can isolate purely the internet connection.
We recently saw Starlink add a 1 terabyte soft cap for customers. Do you think that may have had any difference to the performance you've seen?
I think it's probably a little too early to tell from that. That was only, if I remember rightly, about a month or so ago, maybe 2 months or so ago. Mm-hmm. It's quite a... I think soft is the key word there. It's quite a generous cap. So 1 terabyte's a fair amount of traffic. But it's not like they're going to start charging you for more beyond that point. I understand they rate limit you after that, but I don't think it said what that rate limit is. And I think you can pay for additional premium traffic, as they call it, beyond that point. I suspect they've got a small proportion of users which are probably using a disproportionately large amount of traffic. So this is basically about making sure that the few don't spoil it for the many. I don't think it will have a massive amount of difference on network performance. I think it will help with that long tail. So where there are areas of significant congestion, then it will help reduce the impact on people who are suffering.
What are the challenges of measuring Starlink performance compared to regular fiber connections?
In general, satellite services have a much higher round-trip time. So for traditional satellite services from the likes of, I don't know, Hughes or Viasat, you'd be looking at around 600-700 milliseconds round-trip time plus. That's much better than it used to be. When we first started doing this like 15 years ago, it would be about 1,200 milliseconds round-trip time. And there was all kinds of funky things they would put inside the modem to cache HTTP traffic and try and compress data upstream and downstream to minimize the impact of that very high round trip time. Now, for Starlink, they are obviously much closer to the users. They're not quite as high in orbit around the Earth, obviously. Yeah. So the latency is much lower. It's typically, I say 100 milliseconds is around the average. It can be plus or minus a bit, and obviously can be plus quite a bit if there's congestion. But 100 milliseconds is the average. So from a measurement perspective, it doesn't make a huge difference, because there can be some DSL services if you're in a really rural area in parts of the US or Canada, for example, where you can have a round trip time of 80 milliseconds. Yeah. So an extra 20 milliseconds isn't a huge deal. I'd say the main thing you have to think about from a measurement perspective is trying to capture the fluctuations. So that might mean periods of a lack of connectivity where you can't get any packets through at all, or where the round trip time spikes significantly, or where the throughput degrades. It's certainly not as stable as, say, a fiber to the home service. So I think it's important to try and capture that in any measurement methodology. So to the second part of the question, what have we had to do differently to measure Starlink? Nothing. we don't do anything different for Starlink than we do for other services. We use the same methodology, whether you're on a 1 megabit DSL connection or a 10 gigabit fiber to the premises connection. In some cases, we will use more or fewer TCP connections, depending on, say, some regulatory requirements. But in general, no, we don't need to do anything here. We use all of our same regular measurements on Starlink that we do everywhere else.
So just to drill into that issue with coverage coming in and out, if there's no coverage and you can't take a speed test result, presumably they just get wiped from the averages, do they? How do you account for that in your results?
So if we can't run a speed test because there is no coverage at the time, there is just no IP connectivity, then that just shows up as a failure in our database. We don't include failures in the averages for speed tests. Mm-hmm. Because the speed test is a measure of how fast or how much bandwidth you can push through the pipe at any one time.
Yeah.
So we don't include failures in the average there, because one failed speed test would drag the average down to zero for that period, and it doesn't make sense.
Yeah.
Of course, it's really important not to just paper over the issue of a lack of coverage, because it's great if you can get 150 megabits per second for 30 minutes every day. But if the other 23 and a half hours you have no coverage at all, then you're going to be pretty cheesed off.
Yeah.
I'm just making those numbers up. That's not pointing to anything real, to be clear. So we do have lots of other metrics that capture outages or disconnections. So the most obvious one is a simple packet loss metric. Mm-hmm. Our packet loss metric runs continuously. Our latency and packet loss metric runs continuously. So we're not just sampling it every, say, 10 seconds within an hour, running some simple pings. We are sending a constant stream of traffic, and we're sampling how often packets drop across the entire hour. We aggregate it by hour, but we send packets roughly once every 1.5 seconds. So packet loss is one way to see it. Mm-hmm. Another way to see it is what we call outages. So we capture periods of contiguous packet loss. That's when two or more consecutive packets are lost. We characterize that as an outage. And we show that in our SamNose One dashboard to the consumers. It's kind of like a timeline for the day. And there's little vertical red bars indicating when outages occur. So if you look at a very poor connection, you can just see this like little striped pattern of red bars indicating outages. And that's obviously not a good thing. You want a nice clean display which shows nothing. So I'd say those are the two main ways we have of characterizing that kind of unreliability. But of course, we have dozens of other metrics which look at things of like stability of throughput, stability of latency, jitter, application-specific metrics. But most of the time, for now, when we're talking about Starlink, we're mostly concerned, to be frank, about the access network, about the link between your home with the satellite. I forget what they call the dishy, I think, mm-hmm. With the satellite receiver on your home, and up to the satellite, and then back down to the ground station. Most of the time, that's where the bottlenecks and the reliability issues are going to be. It won't so frequently at the moment be upstream of that in, say, the application providers or in Starlink's backhaul, because they're going to suffer congestion wise will be on the access network for now, simply because they're scaling up so rapidly.
We're yet to see Amazon launch its long-awaited competitor to Starlink. Do you think this first move advantage is going to prove crucial for Starlink?
I think it will definitely help, because they're going to get a lot of people who have a pent up demand for this kind of service. So I know they've launched all kinds of things. They've got the RV ones for people with the mobile homes in the US. They've got the one for boats as well. And I think there's something around aviation coming out as well. So there's all that pent up demand for people who are suffering of poor quality broadband for many years now. Mm-hmm. And Starlink's going to hoover all of that up. Of course, there's not really much in the way of switching costs, though, right? If Amazon or someone else comes along and offers a much better service, which is way more reliable or way faster, then there's nothing to stop customer from switching to them whenever their contract is up. It's not like there's any hugely complicated infrastructure or very long-term contracts involved. They simply have to install a different dish on their home. So I think the first mover advantage will be beneficial. It will help, but I wouldn't say it's going to be crucial for Starlink.
In the time since we last looked at Starlink, it's announced a partnership with T-Mobile to eliminate dead spots in the mobile network, albeit in a very limited form. Do you think filling gaps in mobile coverage is likely to become a big part of Starlink's proposition?
I think it certainly could be. It's hard to say at the moment. They're trying lots of different things simultaneously, and who knows which one will succeed or which one will stick. If they do have success here, then it's hard to imagine that that some of the other mobile operators in the US and abroad wouldn't want to consider doing something similar with Starlink, or maybe someone like OneWeb or potentially Amazon. But yeah, I can definitely see convergence of these kinds of services in the not too distant future. We already saw something a few months ago that Apple announced with their new iPhone release, which is the joining up with, I think it's the Globalstar or Globestar satellite services for the emergency SMS.
Yeah.
So I can see more of this kind of meeting of the minds between different technologies.
Talking of which, Starlink has announced Starlink Aviation, which is bringing that service to airlines as well. Do you think we're reaching the point where internet connectivity will be available anywhere on the planet before long?
Probably, yes. Whether that's a good thing, who knows? I quite enjoy getting away from the internet connectivity. But yeah, I imagine it probably will be available pretty much everywhere. Although you don't always have perfect GPS reception on your phone or on a GPS unit, for example, if you're in amongst, say, tall buildings or, you know, in a canyon or something like that. So there's still going to be areas. But I think the aviation one is potentially interesting. There's lots of different techniques have been tried for bringing internet connectivity to planes. There's been ground-based stations firing service up to planes. There's been traditional satellite services firing service down to planes. And they've all been a bit patchy. I don't know if any of the listeners who've tried broadband services on planes, they are really hit and miss.
Yeah.
Whether that's the fault of the providers or whether it's the fault of the airlines, it's really hard to work out sometimes. But anything that Starlink and others can do to help the industry up their game, I think is a good thing.
Ofcom recently announced it was licensing more spectrum for satellite services to provide future bandwidth for connecting road vehicles and trains and unmanned aircraft systems. Do you think satellite broadband will become predominantly used by those commercial services, or do you think it's more of a consumer play?
I think this goes a little bit back to the T-Mobile example that you talked about earlier. I think we're probably going to end up seeing hybrid services where devices, I use that in the loosest possible sense. It might be a laptop, it might be a phone, it might be a car, it could be anything. We'll perhaps use mobile networks as a first point of contact, then services like Starlink, low Earth orbit ones, and then maybe full satellite services in the future. And they will seamlessly switch between these as long as they can get some connectivity. Mm-hmm. And obviously, you know, differing levels of service from each one. So it might start off with commercial services, but I think it will quickly become available to consumer devices, consumer applications, even if consumers don't necessarily think about it or it's not necessarily marketed towards consumers.
That's it for this episode of the Sam Knows podcast. Make sure to read the article that accompanies this podcast and all of our previous articles at samknows.com/spotlight. Until next time, goodbye.